Welcome to the Leading Deeply podcast. I'm Dr. Joe Albert, coach, consultant, and teacher, interested in storytelling and helping people thrive.
And I'm Dr. Beck Burson, a physician and psychiatrist fascinated by neurons and narratives and how people change. Thanks for joining us at Leading Deeply, a space to get curious how individuals and organizations address the undeniable desire we all have for meaning, purpose, and belonging. We want to know how leaders and those aspiring to lead can engage and animate these human needs to cultivate flourishing.
It's a short time here. What are you going to do with it? And what matters? And are you willing to commit yourself to what really deeply is wishing expression in the world through you?
At Horizon Credit Union, community is who we serve, and helping you grow is our goal. Your path is our purpose, and together we can make a positive impact. Whether you're ready for a checking account, a home loan, or a team that cares about your dreams, doing business here does good in the community. Discover the difference and open your account today or find a branch near you at hzcu.org. Horizon Credit Union is an equal housing opportunity lender insured by NCUA.
I'm Joe Albert, and with me is Dr. Beck Burson. Today, our topic is about discovering meaning and how that illuminates purpose in our work and in our lives as each of us pursues our calling. What does bring meaning to our lives? As we age and grow, many of us realize that the stories, patterns, beliefs that we have relied on no longer serve us. And so how do we continue on our journeys, choose pathways that will allow us to discover our own compass? As a leader or an aspiring leader, how do we continue to find meaning in our work and inspire others to do the same? And hopefully in the end, creating cultures where people might flourish. This is truly an honor, and Beck and I are very excited to have best-selling author, more than 20 books, thought leader, teacher, Jungian analyst, Dr. James Hollis with us today. So Beck, this is a real treat, huh?
Oh my gosh, I feel like I've been looking forward to this for a while, and we're all in for a treat here with Dr. Hollis. Joe, thank you for introducing me to Jim's work about 2 years ago. It's so life-changing, both for me and my patients. And it's with profound admiration and inspiration that we're honored to be in conversation with him. Today, we're going to be talking about notions of the self, our longings for meaning, and our reactions to fear and how such themes relate to burnout and flourishing. Dr. Hollis is truly an example of somebody who's given a life's work to expressing something transcendent that speaks to us at a very deep level. Without further ado, welcome, Jim. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be with you.
Thank you. And when I teach or when I give a workshop, I will always, I feel bad, Jim, actually saying this, admitting it, but at least one of the slides in my PowerPoint always includes this quote. We're not here to fit in, to be well-balanced, or provide exemplar for others. We're here to be eccentric, different, perhaps strange, perhaps merely to add our small piece, our little clunky chunky cells to the great mosaic of being. As the gods intended, we are here to become more and more ourselves. And every time I share that with people, they're all writing the thing down. Jim, a lot of the work that Beck and I do is around narrative. And if you wouldn't mind, as I read that quote, how did you get to the place where that wisdom, that insight sort of emerged for you? Anything from your own background that you might share that would illuminate some of that?
Well, I think there are really two questions here. First of all, is the question you ask, and then the question that's really the background. So I'll start with the background. We are all creatures who try to make sense of our experience by way of creating narratives. What was that about? Who are you? Who am I? What's going on between us? This is how we try to perceive our world and adapt to it and fit in or at least negotiate in a better way with it. And of course, our stories that are the narratives of a child or of an infant even often get very sort of hard baked and become reflexive responses to people and situations later in life. So part of the work of analytic therapy is to discern what are the stories, and I put that in quotes, because these narratives may be conscious or may be unconscious, And the problem with the unconscious is it's unconscious, so we can't say very much about it, but they are still players in the executing of our life decisions. So that's part of the work, to identify those necessary stories as we try to make sense of life. In my own life, I grew up in a family that was hard hit by the fates of life. My mother was an orphan. My father was pulled out of eighth grade and sent to work long before child labor laws. And while he wanted to be a physician, he had to work in a factory all of his life. And for them, life was difficult. Economics were always at the forefront. And the message to me was, don't go out there. It's too big. It's too dangerous. Stay here and we'll try to, you know, create our little fortress here and protect each other. And it was a well-meant instruction, both overt and covertly expressed to me and to my brother. But I also knew from the beginning that there was something inside that wanted to see the world, that wanted a larger life. And frankly, I found that larger life through my teachers in school, who became my heroes in life. And also a local city librarian who early on saw me as a child who was hungry to learn. And she said to me after a couple of weeks, she said, you don't have to stay in the children's section anymore. You can use any place you want in the library. And she even introduced me to the basement where they had archives there as well. And I look back upon those moments as really something affirming. Yes, this is a journey. What is your life about? How is it to be realized in the world out there? And to properly live it, you need to leave home, if not physically, at least psychologically. And of course, I wound up doing both, as many people do. But it was the beginning of the journey. And so there is something inside of each of us that A, knows us better than we know ourselves, and B, is wanting to express itself out there in the world. Now, there may be many forces around us that are opposed to those forms of expression, you know, gender limitations, sexual orientation limitations, et cetera, et cetera. But something inside sickens and sours when it's not allowed to express itself in the world. And this is not about self-absorption. This is not about narcissism. It's actually asking to be served. In other words, and I'll stop in a moment, but the agenda of the first half of life, speaking very loosely, is to develop enough ego strength to go out into the world, to leave our home, to leave our parents, step out in the world and form relationships at work, at home, and with our children and so forth. But then the second half of life, at some point, it occurs to a person, well, but why am I still here? I've done the things I was supposed to do. What now am I supposed to do? Just repeat that for another few decades if I'm allowed to live that long? And it was at that point I was blessed, although I didn't think of that at that time, with a midlife depression at age 35, right on schedule. Midway in life's journey, I found myself in a dark wood, as Dante wrote. I found myself with a disabling depression, and I went into my first hour of therapy. And that was the beginning of another kind of journey. And the journey was both external, in the sense I traveled all the way to Switzerland to retrain from being a humanities professor to working as a Jungian psychoanalyst. And secondly, an inner journey to begin to explore the vast reaches that we carry within us at all times. So in a somewhat long-winded fashion, that's, you know, my story in a nutshell.
Oh, that's powerful. Just real briefly, I in the last few years for me, I moved from Jersey to Spokane, Washington, worked at Gonzaga University for quite a while, and we moved down to California, my wife and I, and 3 years ago she contracted COVID and passed away, and then I had heart failure right after that and was in the ICU for a while, and you know, they basically weren't going to resuscitate me, but somehow I came through it. And that really became, to read your work more deeply, be honest with you, and with a lot more relevance than I had ever had read it before, you know, and about sort of this, what next in my life, and, you know, what's going to give my life meaning going forward. And so thank you for, in a way, it's a map. It's a bit of a map that you provide. At least it has been for me. So I'm deeply appreciative of it. So thank you. So Beck.
Yeah, I really appreciate how everything kind of fits together. I'm wondering for our listeners, when you talk about story, when you talk about how we make sense of our environment, if there could be some tools that could be helpful as far as concepts, could you get our listeners up to speed with some of the tools and trying to understand concepts like the sense of self versus the capital S self and the role of the unconscious?
Well, first of all, the problem with the unconscious is that it's unconscious, so we can't literally speak of it, and yet it keeps spilling into the world through us. I've often said to individuals, if you want to start your personal analysis, start with your own life patterns. Particularly focus on those places where you feel stuck, or focus on those places for where you're doing what you know at some level is counterproductive for you, hurtful to you, maybe hurtful to others, and yet for reasons you don't know, you keep serving those directives. And where are they coming from? So then one has to ask a question that we need to ask really of all of our significant choices in life. What is this in service to inside of me? Where's this coming from inside of me? You may not know immediately the answer, but if you keep asking the question, I can assure you things start floating up from below. And you begin to realize, for example, those adaptations that we made as children and had to make as children, because, you know, one thing we all learn as children is the world's big and you're not, the world's powerful and you're not. So how are you going to cope with that for a few decades? Well, you wind up developing patterns of avoidance, which is rational and understanding, giving understandable if you see the power differential between a child and the adult world. And you have patterns of avoidance, patterns of compliance, and patterns where you secretly try to find your own way. Now, all of those are logical responses to an existential fact that we start off as tiny and vulnerable and dependent and at the mercy of the circumstances into which fate has placed us. Then the question is, all right, is that in some way in accord with what is wanting to express itself through you? And when it isn't, and most commonly it won't be at some point in one's life, the psyche itself will begin to tell us that. It presents symptoms. So when I went into the first hour of therapy at midlife, like anyone else, I was simply wanting to have that depression lifted right away. How quickly do we resume our normal functioning? And I slowly began to realize in the deepening of the work, a work that, as I said, actually led me from Philadelphia to Zurich, Switzerland, that the real question was, why has my psyche autonomously withdrawn its approval and support from the executive decisions that are being made by the brain trust upstairs? You know, why is the lower realm in revolt here? And that's the beginning of wisdom, because then you realize there is a shadow government at work within you. Now, our sense of self is who we consciously think we are. You and I are talking to each other at this moment, consciousness to consciousness, and presumably people are listening as well through their conscious state. But we are a whole world of other swirling energies, emotions, agendas, and so forth at work. So anything that we happen to say here or illustrate might trigger in any of our listeners or in ourselves something in our psychological history that activates it. And it comes up and it has the power to momentarily take over one's conscious directions. That's why we often get into these repetitive patterns, because we're in service to some historically generated narrative or splinter script, if you will, that when triggered has the capacity to take over consciousness and enact its old program. So a person might say, well, why did I get so angry yesterday about that? What was that about? It was really a trivial incident, but notice how I responded. Or why did I say yes to that request when in fact I really don't want to do that? What was it in me that took over? You know, that's a humbling experience, but it's the beginning of wisdom to recognize there is a shadow government. One needs to pay attention to where the choices are coming from intrapsychically and to begin to ferret out how many of those responses, those reflexive responses, come from our history. I had a client once in Houston who was a member of AA, and he said that the most popular saying in his group in AA was, "This isn't working for me, but I do it very well." which is a great line, you see, because we all have developed forms of adaptation. And when we're in them, we assume that's who we are and that's what is right for us. It's only when we pull away and get some kind of global view of our life, we begin to realize, all right, these are patterns. And we don't rise in the morning and say, well, today I'm going to do the same stupid and counterproductive things I've done for decades here. But there's a good chance we will. So wisdom begins in this very humbling experience of having to look at what are some of the other drivers that are at work within my life, which are harmful to my well-being ultimately, keep me blocked, keep me stuck, and may even be hurtful to others. And that's the work that we all have to try to do in order to free up our journeys.
You make it so accessible, these concepts that are pretty complicated. And this concept of meaning can also feel just as intimidating. Frankl talks about we're in this vacuum, this abyss of meaning. And you've written a lot about meaning as well. As far as this sense of self versus our capital S self, we're in pursuit of that which seeks expression through us. This true self, how does that relate to meaning?
Well, when we're in harmony, now again, let me just make a distinction upon which you just identified here, or that which you just identified. The self in the Jungian world means the totality of the formative and directive energies within us. It includes the billion functions of your body, the cells that are dying and being replaced, the growing of your toenails, the digestion of your food. Those are not operations run by consciousness, but they're being run by some organic center. And I think that organic center, for which Jung used the phrase self with a capital S, not to be confused with the ego consciousness. So ego consciousness is our sense of who we are. But the self is what is our organic and natural self, our natural identity. And I think it has two agendas. One is self-healing when we get injured and self-protection through symptomatology and so forth. But also it's seeking its own expression in the world. So you're born with certain gifts, you're born with certain talents, you're born with certain interests. And if your culture supports that, then you will have an easier life journey because that the surroundings support the expression of who you really are. If you're not, and this is true for most people in history and most people today probably, the circumstances that are oppositional to that, then you're going to have a struggle. Then you're going to have to, in some way, fight your way through to serve that which is wanting expression through you. So again, the sense of self is who I believe I am in any given moment. But in any given moment, I may be captivated by some formative experience in my past. For example, so much of our behavior is fear-based. And it's understandable that we learn early on how to deal with our fears, ranging from denial to compliance to avoidance and so forth. And then those patterns, as I mentioned, show up later in our relationships to the present world. None of us would turn the driving of our automobile over to, say, a 4-year-old or an 8-year-old, but we do it every day, metaphorically, when we allow this earlier history in our life to make our decisions and create our patterns for us.
I was going to ask about fear, and one of the things after my wife died, I realized that much of who I am, my patterns have become an adaptation to our relationship. And couples, I think, do that, you know. So here I am walking into a department store to buy clothes for myself, which I've never done in my life. And I'm like, oh crap, what do I do here? I don't know what colors or anything. And it just occurred to me that when those adaptations they become realized, you see them. The fear of not using them to sort of manage your life on a daily basis is pretty frightening, I gotta say, you know. And there's a part of me that, boy, I could do anything I want. I can wear anything I want. But there's another part of me that, but I don't know how to do that, you know. And this is pretty unknown territory for me. And I'm curious about, folks you've worked with, but in terms of how they manage their fears and not, and you use that Jungian quote, I think we walk in shoes too small for us. And I always like that. And I use that a lot with my students, and it's true. And so, but it means you're going to step into the unknown, and that, to me at least, that's always been a frightening proposition. And yeah. Sure.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry for your loss, truly. And I'm 84, my wife is 83, and we talk about this about every other day, what happens when one of us passes, and the other will survive and learn new pathways, but it will be a great loss. And of course, as couples, we form reciprocal arrangements, we cover different sides of the territory, and then suddenly you realize you have to do that now all yourself. And I've experience with many of my clients with the loss of a partner, or sometimes even the loss of their work situation or their children moving away. Whenever there's a loss of some kind, we have to acknowledge there was something of value there, or we wouldn't feel it as a loss. But then we have to say to ourselves, all right, now the energy that was invested there, which was rich and valuable, presumably, has now come back to you. What are you going to do with it? You see, it is an opening. It is an abundance. It is a responsibility that one may not wish to have, but nonetheless, one has that. So I was, as recently as 18 months ago, sort of at the edge of death myself through two cancers and two very serious spinal operations that came about possibly because of the cancer treatment, fracturing my spine and so forth. So we moved into a retirement community. So it's not technically a nursing home, it's a co-op, but there's managed care here, not managed care, but skilled nursing care and so forth. So we're very much aware of people who don't show up or people who are unable to walk at some point. And we're surrounded by it. And when you're young, you think, well, that's out there somewhere. It's going to happen to other people. And that's a natural understanding of a younger person. But sooner or later, the body has its own agenda, as we know. And the human ego has to progressively recognize the limitations of the body as well as the directives of the body. Plato said once, the well-lived life is a preparation for death. And he didn't mean that in any morbid sense. He meant that in a sense of it means that we have to undertake a more serious clarification of our values. Mm-hmm. Who are we? What do we stand for? What are the things worth, if need be, suffering for? Mm-hmm. Because if you don't ask those questions, you're really in service often to those infantile complexes that we were just referencing. And it becomes a healthy question. As I've also pointed out in a couple of different books, it's mortality itself that makes life meaningful. If we could just live forever, then life would be dreary. Nothing would matter. You do this for a century, you do something else for another century, does something else. Nothing would matter. Since we're here such a short time, your choices matter. What are they in service to? That's the question. And if you don't ask that question, you'll be in service to the old reflexive protections, which were there for some good reasons, but maybe you've outgrown them. Maybe they undermine your actual freedom of choice in the present moment. The patterns of avoidance and the patterns of compliance, for example, are basically fear-based responses, rather than bringing who we are into a situation and dealing in a good faith negotiation with the world. And so again, underneath all of this, we all have an appointment with our own souls, with our own life. And that's, by the way, what the Greek word psyche means. And psychotherapy from the Greek means to listen to your own soul, listen to the soul. What does it have to say? The moment you use a word like soul, you've entered the world of meaning or the disconnect from meaning. It's not just about your behaviors or your thought process or your biology. It's about what is purposeful in your life. And are you living that purposeful direction? If you're not, what's the price of not doing that?
Oh, I like that. That's I'll turn it back over to Beck, but I remember being in the ICU, hands and feet tied to the rails and intubated and the whole thing. And I came up with eight things that were going to, from the future, as long as I have left, whatever I have left, I'm going to go after those eight things, And that was the first time I think in my life I had felt a very clear, I don't know, path forward. This is what I'm going to work on. And it's been happening, it's, 2.5 years now, I guess, of it, but it's sort of, this podcast is one of those. And so it's really, it's until you've experienced it, I don't know, that sense of, loss and then temporal sort of timeline that you have left, it's one of those, yeah, when I get older, I guess it'll be like that, but not right now. So thanks. Your insight on this is really helpful. Yeah.
It's something that I'm dreading as well, or my wife is dreading, but we'll get through it because life is still to be served, as you well know. So, be back.
Just to dovetail on this theme of fear and how it gets in the way of us living larger lives. I know it's somewhere in your writing where you talk about to sacrifice means to make sacred. I think some etymology has to do with that. And something that is worth suffering for, as you guys were just talking about. I also know you've made the distinction when trying to make decisions of what is worth suffering for, to ask the question, does it make your life larger or smaller? Does it make your psyche, does it make your soul larger or smaller? And how it can be very unique and hard to discern and distinguish where to instill courage. So I have a patient the other day, she's a realtor, and she was offered a multi-million dollar contract, and she was probably going to turn it down. And she was trying to ask the hard question, am I doing this out of fear? There's too much expectation, too much required. Or am I doing this in a sense to make myself, my psyche, my soul expand because I'm not relying on a shadow self to do some ambitious thing? Could you talk about trying to distinguish the role of fear and that it's not the same for everybody? What one person's challenge to become larger might be different than another person's.
Of course. Yes, thank you. In 1912, Jung wrote, and I'm paraphrasing here, he said, "The spirit of evil," which is strong language, "the spirit of evil is negation of the life force by fear. Only boldness can deliver us from fear. And if the risk is not taken, the meaning of life is violated." And I've suggested to people, if you write that out and put it on your bathroom mirror, and you have to look at it every morning when you brush your teeth, and you really absorb it, it becomes part of your bones, it'll change your life because you begin to recognize, well, that's really coming from my apprehension about something. This is about me not wanting to take some psychological risk here. And I'm not talking about foolhardy risks. I'm talking about those moments when we have to make some pretty critical decisions and to ask that question, does this path enlarge me? Does it diminish me? And usually you know the difference, usually. And if you don't, you keep asking the question. And I'm talking about enlargement in the psycho-spiritual sense, that you become a larger human being. It doesn't necessarily mean you'll make more money, you'll have a better office, setup in the new situation, whatever might be tempting there. It's about what is it that pulls something out of you, which is meant to be used, and what is it that really calls to you that matters and abides. Now, that can vary at different stages in our life, of course. And at one point, one's highest calling is to take care of our children, for example. Other times, it's about stepping into maybe a new career direction or a new set of relationships with people. But it also is something that is unique to each person. What are you called to do with your life? And generically speaking, we're all called to become a fuller, richer human being. A lot of forces have contended against that, as we've mentioned, including the need to fit in to a culture. But the culture is ultimately, in its own way, pathological. The culture says to us, well, you're here to have fun, to be happy, to enjoy your life, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing per se is wrong with that. But in the end, that becomes superficial. In the end, that becomes addictive. In the end, that betrays your deeper needs as a human being. What is it that you find that pulls upon you, that demands your best person in this regard? What is it that causes you to grow as a human being? And that's where we have those critical decisions to make. And too often, fear or feelings that I'll be out there on my own, nobody will understand that. Jung talked about that. He said, when an individual feels a calling of some kind, it means leaving the collective, and that can instill a debt burden, D-E-B-T, a debt burden. And he said that debt is repaid ultimately by returning to the collective, to your family, to your work life, to your society, as a richer human being, psychologically speaking, as a larger person, psychologically speaking. And I don't mean by that grandiose in any way, but I'm talking about your gift is your personhood, ultimately. That's what you share with others. A sentence in Jung that has always haunted me, and I think in a very constructive way, is where Jung said, the greatest burden the child must bear is the unlived life of the parent. So therefore, it's incumbent upon me to step into the largeness of my journey. When I do that, I'm opening the door for my children to imagine the larger life, psychologically speaking. When I don't, they're going to be stuck at the same place or be spending their lives trying to overcome that stuckness which I have bequeathed to them.
Wow. Every summer I go to the Jersey Shore, and every summer my family, well, when are you moving home? I said, well, it has been 47 years. I mean, I'm probably I'm not feeling like I'm going to be moving back to Jersey anytime soon. But there's a sense of, for me at least, feeling larger when I go back. I don't know if I would have gotten there if I hadn't left. And not everybody leaves. I mean, I get that, you know. I mean, I needed to, I think, ultimately. But that's a fascinating sort of depiction, at least of my experience, you know, and feeling and hard to describe to people until that you've done it, you know, what it's like to leave what you know, who you know, and take that journey, you know. So that just captures it exactly, you know.
Sure. Well, and again, it's not about whether or not you leave the place where fate placed you. It's whether or not your choices are driven by fear or something in you that is wanting to find its own expression. And, you know, if you stay at home, it could be productive and enlarging, or it could also be that one's need for familiarity, security, et cetera, has triumphed over, you know, your life journey. The journey has to happen, in my view. It doesn't have to be a geographic journey, but it has to be a journey of the spirit. And if the spirit hasn't in some way left home, then you've never really grown up. You know, a grown up is a person who holds themselves accountable, is not into the blame game, but holds themselves accountable, and says, all right, I am not going to allow fear or conventionality to keep me from finding the life I want to live. And that may be a very difficult choice. But then if you don't make it, then something in the soul dies at that moment. And wherever we're making fear-based choices, something in the soul is being violated. You can count on that.
Yeah. That's exactly my experience. So,
yeah, that's just so resonant and true, this idea to ask ourselves, is this decision in service to fear or not? Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of courage to look at the shadow self, to look at projection. And a lot of our listeners are curious about, how do I go from burnout to flourishing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this idea that burnout has a lot of etiologies. It could be not having meaning. It could be moral injury. It could be exhaustion, cynicism, all these different markers. But could you talk about the role of facing our fears when it comes to projection and what we put onto our careers and how that can ultimately potentially lead to burnout?
Sure. Well, first of all, let's be clear about a projection. A projection is not something I consciously do. It means something in my unconscious has been triggered, activated. You know, you could be driving to work and the car radio's on and you're not even particularly listening, but maybe there's a song there. And you get to work and you're in a mood state and you don't know where it's come from, but it's because that song happened to hit a lost memory, maybe a lost relationship or something like that. So again, one has to be mindful of the fact that there are many clusters of psychological energy that are intrapsychic that we carry wherever we go. That's why I've actually used the phrase the Seattle solution to folks, because I've been operating primarily in the East Coast. Sometimes people think, oh, I need to move to Seattle just to do this or do that. But the problem is you open your suitcase and all of your history followed you, you know, and you sort of replicated there in the new setting. It's nothing against Seattle. If I were, you know, speaking in Seattle, I would call it the Florida solution or something like that. But again, underneath this, something wishes to be lived, something that may not feel comfortable, but is nonetheless demanding. You know, for example, and this is a trivial example at one level, I'm a card-carrying introvert, but my outer life is extroverted, which is not easy for me, but it's part of my calling. In other words, if I care about these matters, if I found them helpful to me and to my clients, why would I not want to share that with other people? So that's why I do things like a podcast like this. It's not a natural function, but it's something that is consistent with my sense of purpose in life. So again, you have to say, what is this journey about if it's not a meaningful journey? You can put it this way very simply. He said, the smallest of things with meaning is always greater than the largest of things without meaning. And something in us knows the truth of that. The question is, are we living that? And if you're going to live that, it's going to, at some point, require some tough decisions. Stepping into a place that is going to demand something from you. But it, you know, once you're suffering then and rendering sacred is the sacrifice, you know, maybe of your comfort zone, of your old protections. You know, it wasn't easy for me to live in a foreign culture and a foreign language for 6 years as I did. And it was not my intention when I started to change my career and so forth. But all of that was stepping into the largeness of the journey. And step by step, it took me to a different place. And I remember, for example, I'd been in training for 4 years, which was a significant amount of time, of course. When I walked out of my analyst's office, having had one more dream repeat a certain kind of response to a life situation I was dealing with, and was saying the same thing, and it's like it was one, the proverbial feather that tilts something in the balance, and I said to myself, holy cow, or words to that effect, there is a psyche, there is a self, capital S, that knows what's right, and it's been speaking to me for a very long time. And I think at that moment, this whole commitment to the process, which had been a work of the mind, so to speak, shifted to a work of the heart. And it became something real and something personal. And I think it was transformative. And life has been different from that point. But one needs to know at some level, there is something inside, as I said to you before, that knows you better than you do, that has, you know, some engagement with the world that may or may not be easy for you, but which is, over time, the thing that will make your life the richest, psychologically speaking. Many of the people that we would admire in history had very difficult lives. It didn't spare them from suffering, even martyrdom. But we admire them because something in them held fast to something that was profoundly true and important for them. And they chose to live that. And that's why they are exemplars to the rest of us, you know, struggling up the same mountain.
Wow. Well, Jim, we're coming to the close in terms of our time frame. And Beck and I talked about this before you got on with us about your writing is so clear, insightful, and inspiring, and you're exactly like that as we interviewed you, which is really a gift. And I can't thank you enough for your clarity and your willingness to sort of share your journey with us. I mean, that's I just deeply appreciative of it.
Well, thank you very much, Joe. It's a pleasure to be with you and to have this conversation.
Yep.
You too, Beck.
Thank you. Are there any other themes you'd want to address before we close, or any other closing comments for our listeners?
Well, I've always carried in my heart and my mind Jung's comment in a letter where he said once life is a short pause between two great mysteries. Know not from whence we came, we know not whither we go, but all we know for sure is this brief pause that we call our lives. And what is it about? What are you going to do with it? That's not someone else's decision to make. That's something that comes to each of us both as a gift and as a challenge. And so it's again the brevity of life that requires us to recognize our choices matter and what are our choices in service to. And the failure to ask those questions is going to lead to a diminished life rather than a life that we're meant to live. So I would encourage each of your listeners to reflect on those patterns that they find self-defeating and recognize sooner or later, what I fear is now my agenda. I need to take that on, not necessarily in a literalistic sense. If you're afraid of heights, you don't have to, go skydiving. Don't be too literal, but understand what it means psychologically to you. Where is it you're being blocked by a fear of being alone in the process or a fear of retribution or whatever? And realize, all right, therein is an agenda for me to address, not to force some kind of artificial response, but to have a deeply considered response over time. Again, that's what the word therapy means, to listen to or pay attention to the expression of the soul. And what is the soul asking of you? That's a question that we need to ask every day of our lives throughout the journey. And that dialogue is what brings about the richness of life. And the failure to address that, which is really what popular culture, distracts us from asking, is going to lead to a diminished life. So it's a short time here. What are you going to do with it? And what matters? And are you willing to commit yourself to what really deeply is wish and expression in the world through you?
Wow. Thank you, Dr. James Hollis. I'm looking at my What Matters Most copy. You can see all the sticky notes I have in it. There's just so much there that has continues to inspire me. Go on Amazon, order books, and they're just inspiring. So great, great experience for Beck and I, and we're deeply appreciative, Jim, of your time. And please take care of yourself, and we'll continue to look for more from you. So thank you.
You're welcome, Joe, and pleasure to meet you and meet Beck as well.
Thank you. Wow. What is an experience. And his clarity, it just is in his writing, and of course, just hearing him speak is really a gift, I think, to all of us. So this has been a treat for me, and a lot of things sort of fell together. I was trying to take notes, but also listen at the same time. So how was it for you?
Oh, it was such a gift. He brings up so many important points and is so expert in his ability to articulate them in a way that really penetrates to a deep level. I work with a lot of physicians, and I couldn't help but think about some of these concepts in my own life of, like, consciously we go into our calling or profession for maybe a generic, well-meaning purpose. I want to help people, but there's, underneath that, something else going on as far as living out the unlived life of our parents or trying to do something that we're not conscious of. And being able to navigate into that realm of asking those questions: what is making my psyche, my soul bigger? What do I really need to be looking at courageously? It just really made an impact on me, as his writing has as well. I just felt really fortunate to be in conversation with him. Yeah, how about you?
There's this song by Bruce Springsteen, not surprising I reference Springsteen, but But the fact that Jim lived in Jersey for a while is pretty cool. Bruce has a song where he says, you know, may our sins be our own. And you talk about you as a parent and stuff. And that point that Jim made, I thought, was pretty profound about how we'll pass along sometimes our fears and our, you know, limitations, so forth, to the kids, unless we deal with them ourselves, you know. And that's inspiring, but as scary as anything, you know, it really is. So I feel like I'm glad I mean, my wife and I, but we took a lot of risks over the years. And, you know, the final one was moving down from Washington State. And, you know, but for us, it was just facing like our fears, but also going after what we wanted. But also, I think for the kids, for them to see that, you know what I mean? That, yeah, I mean, it's risky and it's crazy. And there's that quote in Jim's book, you choose growth or security. You can't have both, you know, and I think we always tried to choose growth in a way, you know, and at risk, and, you know, of losing the security of a job or whatever it might be. So, it just reminded me how useful, for me at least, his writings have been and will continue to be, I think, you know.
So. You know, I know a lot of our listeners are leaders or those aspiring to lead, and maybe it didn't seem like we were pointedly asking questions about leadership, but really all of this has to do with leadership, how we lead ourselves, how we lead other people, mm-hmm. being aware of those hidden drives, those things that we do that, or things that we don't do that are in service to something that we need to be aware of because it impacts the other. Yes. And I think having the bedrock of these concepts is absolutely essential to be an effective leader and doing this deep work.
Yeah, if you're in a leadership role and you haven't done some of this work, I you know, you're at risk, you know, because leadership presses all the buttons, you know, your weaknesses, the unknown parts, you know, the Johari window, the mm-hmm. stuff that's blind to you. And it's like, boy, if you haven't dealt with some of those, it's going to come at you. And you have to be prepared to manage all the stuff that you face along the way. And that's exactly what Jim's talking about here. I think, at least, you know, is a pretty full, but, you know, a willingness to go into the desert in a way internally and face your own demons and, you know, the fears and so forth. And I think good leaders do that, honestly, the most authentic ones, you know what I mean? So, but you're right. I mean, we didn't talk a lot explicitly about leadership, but the whole thing's about being a leader, I think, and what he writes about and so forth. So hopefully people got some good takeaways from his stuff, you know? Yeah.
Well, and just his articulation about the role of story. You know, I know we use story a lot as something that is positive and helps us make sense of things, but how story can also really strangulate our growth because we remain stuck in it. And kind of that paradox that story mm-hmm. is both life-giving and can cut off life, and yep. being able to have the awareness of what our story is and how can we make it bigger.
Yeah. And that's why that saying about, you know, we you don't tear a wall down until you know why it was built, you know, Tillich, maybe Paul Tillich. And it's like, yeah, know that wall, know what you're tearing down and realize why you're tearing it down, I think, is because it's a narrative that doesn't serve us any longer. And it's been our companion. It's been what we've leaned on and relied on throughout our lives, but now it's causing us to bump up against a wall, a limitation that I think we feel called to move through. And so that's hard. It's just, it's scary to let go of that narrative as something you can depend on, an anchor or a compass, and then hopefully find a new one, you know, because you don't know if there's something else is out there or not for you. And I think that's scary. You know, but that's the risk. That's the whole notion of liminality. You know, you're on this threshold of the unknown, but that's where your future lies, I think. You know, so anyway,
no, that's a beautiful response, Joe, to that concept of fear and both being in our story, but also beyond our story, and that transition, that transformation that has to take place is terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And I do think, you know, the desert fathers, you know, the mystics and so forth, a lot of them, I think, went in physically to the desert, but it's really about facing this fear of the unknown and what's really out there that I haven't sort of explored or seen yet. And it's like, oh my God, it is hard. It's yikes. You know, when I left Jersey to move out to Washington, I was 24 or whatever I was, you know, I had never lived any place but home, you know, the same bedroom my whole life. And so, you know, I went through college that way and everything. And then suddenly I'm driving out to Washington State where I've never been. And my God, you know, I don't even know if I knew how scared I was, you know. And same with moving down here, pretty frightening in a lot of ways. So what the heck? And I've never regretted those decisions, you know, any of those that where you sort of take something on that you're afraid of, but you take it on anyway, lean into it. And maybe you'll make it, maybe you'll flop, maybe who knows, you know, that's what I always tell myself. It's okay, Joe, whatever, you know, we'll figure it out. And I always have, you know, thus far, but he articulates in such a way that I'm like, thank you, Jim, you know, it really is like that. So anyway.
Totally. Cool. Well, as far as just directing our listeners on how to find more resources, I like how understated he is. He doesn't have a huge social media presence or, you know, some funnel that leads you to him. But I have just found a lot of rich material going to YouTube or going to Spotify and listening to interviews with him and then reading his books. He's got, I think, 19 books. He's working on a 20th to my knowledge.
Yeah.
So if you just go to his name, jameshollis.net, again, that's James, HOLLIS.net. And it has an overview of different interviews, his books, his lecture schedule. If you'd like to try and get more information from him, he is such a treasure trove of amazing content. Thanks again for joining us today on Leading Deeply. We know there's lots of places you can spend your time, and it means a lot to us that you'd spend it in this conversation with Dr. James Hollis. If this is information that you value, feel free to go to leading-deeply.com. Again, that's leading-deeply.com and sign up for our newsletter where you can get more information on ways to connect with meaning, purpose, and belonging. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day.